Well, I think they're important because it's one way that it gives voice to the Latino community, and also it's a way to get youth interested. It's like cartoons, so anyone can pick it up and be interested and look at it and learn from it. And then for youth that are into art, sometimes if you don't see anyone or anything to relate to, it could be frustrating. And so for them to be exposed to that, it could be inspiring.
The comics were really important to me because I felt like such a freak and such an outsider, and I felt like I didn't belong anywhere. Growing up in East LA, I felt like a freak and an outsider. I wasn't really into the same things a lot of like my peers were into. And then at Berkeley, I also felt like an outsider. And I think in the characters of Maggie and Hopie, it was like my first exposure to any type of expression or art in which like I felt many of myself connected and were present in a really kind of realistic and natural way.
The country runs right through a sand, it doesn't even blink an eye.
I think I've probably been reading the Hernandez brothers as a kind of slobbering, abject, absolutely enthusiastic fan pretty much ever since Love and Rockets first started. I've always liked comics. When my friend Brian Tucker showed me Love and Rockets back in the day, I was riveted. The drawing style I kind of fell in love with, and I thought, well, this seems too good to be true. This is great storytelling, amazing female characters, love, sex, hipness, deep humanness, people with all their passions and flaws and embarrassments and moments of nobility, really deep, rich characters, a mixture of family history and personal history. And once you start reading them, not only is the way they are written and the graphics amazing and totally engaging, they're actually like candy to me, or some weird addiction. Like, I have to be careful when I start reading one because I have a lot of trouble putting them down. And that's the thing that writers always say they want to do. They want to write something that you just can't put down. But they're not, it's not trivial. It's not light. This is rich. It's like a great movie and a great novel together.
I make that argument myself when I'm talking to people about why they should read these guys. I mean, they definitely, I think, raised the bar as far as the literary quality of comic books. Gilbert's work really mirrors like a comic book version of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I think you could say that it's an innovation that Jaime very possibly was one of the first people to create an environment that referenced the traditional superhero world, or referenced this traditional fantasy of comic books, but yet focused on average people. And he may have been like the first person to really do that I can think of anyway.
I first encountered the Hernandez brothers, I believe, in Orange County at a bookstore near Irvine. And I was really excited because early on in 1970, I created a two-page comic strip known as Genocide Patrol. And it was sort of a takeoff on the kind of events that were taking off in East LA. And I think at some point, possibly, I thought I might be involved in that. But it was really paying homage to the fact that I learned English and learned about nuclear physics and the theories related to sound and thought and Freud, through the various comic books I read as a child. The comic reading that I did basically helped to build my ability to learn and to oppose the poor education that I was receiving in East Los Angeles. So when I saw that the Hernandez brothers were in the midst of creating work using the comic book format, I felt that it would be really great if young people were to be presented with this. And I encourage everyone to buy several copies of the comic books and give them away to young people.
For more than 25 years, the Hernandez brothers, Gilbert, Jaime, and on occasion older brother Mario, have been creating deeply entertaining, innovative, and sophisticated work in the field of comics art. Known affectionately to their fans as Los Bros Hernandez, Gilbert and Jaime's internationally successful Love and Rockets comic book series played a large role in revitalizing the underground comic scene and shaping and defining the direction of the new alternative comic scene in the 1980s. From the first unprecedented issue of Love and Rockets, with Jaime Hernandez's realistic and unapologetic portrayal of Chicanas and Chicanos in a diverse Southern California punk scene, and Gilbert Hernandez's densely constructed, often surrealistic picture of a small Central American village and its surrounding area, readers of all kinds were hooked. Although there has been some cross-dialogue between the brothers' characters and stories, for the most part their comics worlds are two separate realms connected by the brothers themselves, who do all of their own writing and drawing. In each issue of Love and Rockets, the brothers' stories alternate, feeding off each other while creating a rich dialogue. For example, while Jaime has developed the characters of punk Chicanas Hopi and Maggie and their epic on-again, off-again relationship in Southern California, Gilbert has constructed a microcosm of Latin American life through the stories of Luba and her fictional Central American village of Palomar. By tracing the lives of their numerous characters in real time over complexly evolving storylines during the past quarter century, the brothers have connected the political, economic, and cultural forces at work between Southern California and Latin America from the end of the Cold War to the present through very personal, powerful stories. What has really set the brothers' comics apart have been complex narrative structures that intertwine and explore individual and community experience, as well as a sophisticated, inclusive portrait of gender and sexuality identities and relations. With well-developed female characters like Hopi, Maggie, and Luba, and characters of all sexual orientations, the Hernandez brothers have dramatically expanded the thematic parameters not only of comics, but of American literature as well. In addition to their groundbreaking content, the Hernandez brothers' experimentation with graphics and literary forms also set the tone in comics for decades to come. Over the past few months, I had the opportunity to talk about Los Bros Hernandez with a number of Los Angeles area-based artists, scholars, punks, and comics fans, as well as with Jaime Hernandez himself. What follows are excerpts from these conversations. Brian Tucker is a faculty member at Pasadena City College, where he also serves as the director for the school's art gallery. In late 2005, Tucker curated a highly successful and widely attended exhibition of the Hernandez brothers' work. Classically trained in art history and technique, and a longtime reader and teacher of comics, Tucker is an expert in both fields and the ways that they overlap. He has a unique perspective on comics and the work of the Hernandez brothers in particular. I asked him to describe the initial impact of Love and Rockets when the series debuted in the early 80s.
Somewhere around 80, or the very early 80s, the Hernandez brothers came in and were picked up quickly by Fantagraphics, and here was this cross between what seemed like a mainstream comic format, very, very mainstream. I mean, it wasn't the mainstream of superheroes at all, but of Archie Comics, Harvey, Dell, this kind of early 60s children's comics. And yet somehow it had this content that was much more adult, but it was a different idea of adult than what the underground comics had been. There was a certain amount of a kind of, especially in the early days, this kind of goofy stuff with the rocket repair. But immediately there was a level of characterization that one hadn't seen much of, if at all, in comics. And then pretty quickly you began to see how they were making these very, very extended stories, although early on you couldn't imagine how extended they would become, and how, in some cases, basically the same characters are carrying on still today.
According to Tucker, this combination of elements in the Hernandez brothers' work resulted in comics that were at once unique and groundbreaking, while at the same time highly accessible.
The Hernandez brothers are this funny combination, because it's like we're weirdos, but we're mainstream too. And there was this kind of friendliness, particularly in Jaime's work, that was so immediately accessible to, I think, anyone who'd read a comic that is not characteristic of either what Spiegelman or Crumb were offering, both of which were much more sort of challenging to the reader.
For Dr. Charles Hatfield, author of Alternative Comics and Emerging Literature, and an assistant professor of English at California State University, Northridge, this combination of experimentation and accessibility resulted in an important cross-dialogue that expanded comics readership and expectations and laid the groundwork for the emergence of alternative comics. Dr. Hatfield specializes in comic art, visual art, and children's literature and culture, and sees the launch of Love and Rockets as a defining moment in the history of both comics and American literature in general.
I think the work of the Hernandez brothers made a strong impression on several different kinds of readers. Those who were already deeply immersed in the culture of comic books, the comic book hobby, comic book fandom, and those who were not. In the long run, the way that they appealed to those who were not immersed in the hobby may be the most important thing, for they extended the reach of comic books, and they brought new kinds of readers to comics, first to their own work, and then in some cases to other comics. In other words, they proved to be a kind of gateway drug for comics, for some readers, those who were not already hip deep in that hobby. So those of us who were already proud comics geeks, so to speak, and those of us who were only within arm's length of that, or maybe not even that, who were outside of comic book fandom, but were curious about what the brothers were representing, both kinds of readers, if I can speak of kinds, were drawn in by that work. And that was really important, because what we had then was people who were not accustomed to talking to each other who began to talk to each other. And so they helped to kickstart alternative comics. That's the easiest way to put it in a nutshell. They were the standard bearers of a movement that came to be known as alternative comics. They had a diverse set of influences, diverse tastes, the ability to reach diverse readers, and to bring new things into comics, and that was just a kick up the backside. I think it was really important for comics, the things that they were bringing culturally and thematically that were new and different.
Charles Hother is the book buyer at Skylight Books in Los Feliz. A longtime reader of Love and Rockets, with tattoos of Hernandez brothers' characters to prove it, Hother remembers the Southern California punk scene that both informed and was reflected in the Hernandez brothers' work. For Hother, the punk DIY aesthetic of the time was one of the key elements in the Hernandez brothers' originality. As he sees it, while the punk aesthetic meant a rejection of commercial success, it also allowed for the kind of freedom of artistic pursuit that resulted in the brothers' ability to appeal to a diverse audience and carve out their own unique place in the comics world.
That DIY aesthetic, and that was a very real thing for me growing up, and I'm sure it was for them too, because in the 1980s, that was all you had. I mean, if you were in music, unless you wanted to be a hair band wearing spandex, you just basically sacrificed the idea that you could ever have a career doing what you love in music, right? Because the whole situation was completely sewn up. And I'm sure that is probably true as well, or was true as well, for comic books and the underground art scene, where because they didn't want to write stories about superheroes battling for the fate of the universe, they wanted to write these other stories, and they just accepted that was going to be the case, that you don't have that kind of exposure, you're not going to have that kind of distribution, because you want to do these stories that the Marvel and DC and the people who actually distribute this stuff are not going to be interested in, right? And at that time, that kind of thing was also a point of pride. I mean, it seemed to be a much more clear-cut, black-and-white world about who was a sellout and who wasn't. And, you know, that aesthetic, the punk aesthetic, it goes right, I mean, it permeates their work inherently, because they were working in this underground DIY environment during that era. And that was the whole idea of that punk aesthetic, was, you know, about doing your own thing, not worrying about, you know, getting signed with a major label or getting hooked up with DC or Marvel. I mean, I think that aesthetic and that culture, I'd be willing to bet money that it was a pretty big influence on the direction of their character themselves and their desire to do these things that were outside the mainstream. Even if they weren't consciously making a decision to do that, the fact that they come from that background, you know, obviously has an influence, and their work obviously fits within that canon of people who were doing their own thing at that time. Iconoclastic, unapologetic about blatant eroticism, deconstructing the superhero myth and all these things that they were doing that were not part of mainstream culture. I think pretty much anything anybody was doing at that time that was creative and not part of mainstream culture was influenced by the punk aesthetic. I mean, that's just what it was.
Similarly, Brian Tucker remembers what he calls the somewhat oddball nature of the initial self-published first issue of Love and Rockets in its small zine format, and how it contrasted with the quote-unquote high art experimental approach of East Coast comics artist Art Spiegelman and his publication, Raw.
The very first self-published issue, which is so charming, you know, on this, like, I think it's called book stock, this kind of pretty cheap white stock that, you know, that they got the money and published themselves, and you know, it was very much their own authorship, and I think a totally oddball thing at the time. There wasn't that kind of self-published zine and mini-comic world that there is now. It didn't exist. So it was relatively cheap, straightforward, black and white, and oriented towards storytelling. And that did stand in a real juxtaposition to this lavish, colored, formal investigation of the properties of the medium with, you know, little insert booklets and fold-out things and pull-out flexi discs and all the kind of stuff that was going on in Raw. So I guess it could claim a kind of street-level authenticity, but it was also, it was a lot for them to pull something like that together. It's kind of amazing that they managed to self-publish something like that, and that I'm sure that was probably at the very edge of their means to do that. There's no way in the world, even if they'd wanted to, that they could have published something like Raw.
The punk DIY aesthetic no doubt played a significant role in the development of Love and Rockets, but as Jaime Hernandez explains, it was only one cultural element among many others that he and his siblings experienced as Chicanos growing up in Oxnard, California, a blue-collar agricultural community about 60 miles northwest of Los Angeles. In fact, it was the combination of different cultures and the ways the brothers learned to juggle them all that was perhaps most important in their development as artists.
So I kind of kept it separate. You know, our punk life, we'd go do our punk stuff and then come home and we're regular Chicanos, you know, it's not like we would dress one way, you know, dress one way when we're home and then put on our punk clothes, but it was just something I preferred to keep separate because I wanted to keep my friends as they were, you know, and so it wasn't until we started doing the punk thing more and more that we noticed more ethnic punks were coming out of the woodwork, you know, and we were meeting Chicano punks from, you know, Pico Rivera and stuff like that, you know. And then I realized that when we had our little Oxnard punk scene, that it was really racially mixed. You know, we had Filipinos, we had, you know, Chicanos, you know, white kids, and just a lot of, you know, Oxnard, real blue-collar town, so we just had a lot of working-class kids doing this, the punk thing, and it didn't hit me for till years later that wow, yeah, Oxnard was a really multicultural scene. I guess just putting my own personal life in there, it just turned out that way because here I was Chicano and my characters were, and they were in the punk scene, and then, you know, you deal with, once you're there, you know, you deal with how people treat you and stuff like that. So yeah, the comic didn't have that big a game plan as far as that. I just put them in the position, and then I let it go from there, and I'd say like, okay, well, how would someone treat someone like this?
One result of the Hernandez brothers' ability to juggle so many diverse cultural influences has been an inclusive and sensitive portrayal of some of the most marginalized members of American society. For Joy, a local poet and artist, and a museum educator at MoCA who curates art exhibitions in the Los Angeles area, this inclusiveness in Love and Rockets has meant work that she can relate to. In the Hernandez brothers' characters and stories, Joy finds expression of her own experience growing up in the El Sereno area of Los Angeles.
Then I started reading Love and Rockets and got really into like those characters, Maggie and Hopi, and then like just got into it because I'm like, wow, this sounds like characters, people I know that I grew up with. I grew up in this area, also, you know, and so I used to go to like the backyard gigs and punk gigs around the area, and I saw like just those characters, kind of, they're like punk, they're girls, and they would go to shows. And I was able to relate with them, so that was kind of cool to kind of see people like that are familiar to you.
Sandra de la Loza agrees that so much of Love and Rockets' impact lies in the work's representation of Chicanas and Chicanos, punks, women, and subcultural groups and forms in general. De la Loza is an artist and Chicana-Chicano studies professor at universities throughout Southern California. She recalls her own experience with the work of Los Bros Hernandez.
After I graduated, I bumped into people I had grown up with, and you know, they found that they came to a similar place through very different means. And I think for them, like, you know, subcultural forms were really important for them, to give them voice, to help them develop their consciousness, to help them to create a space, to help form a new, their identities. And, you know, a lot of that growth was made possible by works like the Love and Rockets. One reason that their characters are so intriguing and just grab you and grab so many people, regardless of I think race and gender, is because they capture that experience of just being a teenager and feeling like a freak and feeling uncomfortable in your own skin, and you know, it's being very conscious of the hypocrisy of our society and of dominant culture, not knowing how to make or create something differently, wanting to find a way out and not wanting to like have your spirit squashed.
Brian Tucker also sees this representation of marginalized cultures as a subtle but powerful political statement by the Hernandez brothers, not least because it was something new in comics.
There was some community within the punk scene that, you know, liked them and liked to see themselves reflected there. And then obviously the representation of Chicano life was, in this very mainstream way, was an important political gesture that they managed to handle in such a matter-of-fact fashion. I mean, that's one of the things that's really remarkable about the work, is that it does have this political dimension of representing the specific Mexican-American experience, of representing people in a variety of sexual orientations, racial and ethnic and class statures, you know, mixing all of them up. But it's done in this way that seems so matter-of-fact, that instead of seeming to hold up a fist and saying, you know, yeah, it's about time, it's more like you read it and think, well, you know, what was wrong with all these other comics? Why didn't they just, of course this is the way it is, why didn't they include this too? So I think that was a really remarkable aspect of what they did.
For Jaime Hernandez, the choice to portray traditionally underrepresented and ignored people arose not only from a commitment to correcting media representations of marginalized peoples and to championing the cause of the underdog, but also from a simple desire to write truthfully about his own life and experiences.
In those days, I mean, the undergrounds weren't really alive anymore. And we had discovered punk, and that kind of turned our lives around, you know. We're having fun doing the punk thing, and we're still drawing our comics, and then started to realize that our personal lives were more exciting than the comics we were reading, you know, so the superhero stuff and that stuff started to be not as interesting, and we just decided, like, well, why don't we write about stuff we know, you know, punk rock and lowriders. I guess, first of all, it just comes up from cheering the underdog, you know. I've always liked the underdog. When I talk about fifth class citizens or whatever, you know, it's because, I mean, you got Maggie, she's Chicana, she's a punk rocker, well, in those days when it was dangerous, you know, she's a woman, you know, she's just going down the ladder. I mean, everything you point out about her, you know, she's fat. And one of the main things I've always liked doing about the comic was correcting other forms of comics and entertainment. I thought, well, they don't do it right on TV. You know, well, I'm going to show you how to do it right. They don't do it right here. They don't do it, you know, they don't do it right in comics. I'm going to show you how it's done. You know, I've always done it that way. If some guy comes out with one thing, I'm going to show him how it's done this way. You know, in the early days, I remember all the comic books with the punks in the alley, and then someone pulls out a switchblade. You know, guy with a mohawk pulls out a switchblade. Ooh, he's a thug like that. Well, I never met a punk like that in my life. You know, it's just silly stuff like that. I go, well, I'm going to show you guys how it really is, what I've actually seen. And so the more I do that, the more I'm drawn more to the unwanted, the underdog. kind of a, you know, sticking it to the man kind of thing. And that's the way I do it.
One of the most important and influential aspects of the Hernandez brothers' inclusiveness in their work has been their representations of women, sexuality, and gender identity. Considering the brothers' complex portrait of women's relationships and interior lives, many readers are not surprised to learn that Jaime and Gilbert and their siblings were raised by their mother and grandmother in a woman-centric household after their father died when they were very young. But as Amy Gerstler notes, what is surprising to some is the brothers' own sexuality. For Gerstler, a widely published local writer and a teacher of writing and art, the sexuality of Love and Rockets is one of its most significant dimensions. As she describes, a major part of Love and Rockets' appeal has been the way the Hernandez brothers have consistently portrayed a rich, diverse, and complex picture of human sexuality that unflinchingly reflects reality and that is unexpected and refreshing.
That they talk about human sexuality, refreshing and candid and humane and kind of unblinking, but it's not sensationalistic, although, I mean, it's wild. Some of the books are like almost all sex and so much stuff happens in them and pretty much, I mean, yeah, I think it's great for any writer to be able to go there and then all the more amazing. When Love and Rockets first started coming out and I knew a few people who were reading it, everybody thought the brothers were gay. And the only reason they thought the brothers were gay was because there were a lot of gay characters. And that tends to get shied away from, and a lot of bi characters is all in the mix, just like real human sexuality is. And they were so good at getting inside the heads and hearts of female characters, people thought that equaled gay if they were males. So in a way, that I think says a lot about what, that people are, oh, they couldn't possibly be straight guys and be this perceptive about all different kinds of women. There are really old babes having sex. There are way underage girls, just like in real life. It's amazing. And they write about all kinds of sex, bad sex, tortured sex, failed sex, happy sex, unhappy sex, unexpected sex, sex too early, sex too late. I haven't seen anything where the dead have sex, but I think I just probably missed it because they deal a lot with ghosts and the dead and the past and all that stuff too.
Their portrayal of sexuality and gender in Love and Rockets has earned the Hernandez brothers a substantial following and a reputation for their female characters. But as Charles Hatfield makes clear, their exploration of gender and sexuality is also subversive in its equally rich treatment of male identity and sexuality. Particularly powerful is the way the brothers challenge and dismantle constructions of dominant heterosexual male identity.
That's one of the things that struck me 20 years ago when I began reading them, that there were representations of women and men in their work that were very far from what I was accustomed to seeing in comic books. There was much more tenderness and I think emotional recognition, maybe emotional honesty in their treatment of both women and men. Of course, they're especially known for dealing with female characters because they are favored, privileged characters. They're ongoing characters that they follow most avidly. Are these women characters, a handful that they've created. But as they've grown, they've really done notable things with male characters as well. I now recognize that starting most clearly in the 70s that there was some representation of male homosexuality in American comic books. We can look to the 70s and early 80s, and we can look to things like the anthology Gay Comics and the work of people like Howard Cruise. But outside of the gay-themed press, it was really difficult to find cartoon depictions of homoeroticism, of gay love, of male-on-male relationships. And that just struck me as A, out of the blue, and B, extremely refreshing and a totally new thematic territory that might be explored. And of course, the brothers have continued to work with that. There is, in the work of both brothers, and especially Gilbert, a kind of considered dismantling of masculine stereotypes. In my book, I discuss this with regard to a controversial book by Gilbert called Poison River, which is very dark, a book that deals very much with a kind of male-centered, you know, hyper-masculinist world, and not coincidentally, it's a very unpleasant world compared to many of Gilbert's stories. I think there's a critique of machismo there. It's very strong. It also expresses itself, though, in the brothers' work, and again, especially in Gilbert's, in what I'd call utopian depictions of sexuality, which are not dark. They're rather bright and happy, if sometimes controversial for their explicitness, and we find there too a willingness to turn gender identity upside down. I found too that Jaime, with a great tact and understatement, has really been able to deal much more fully with the male characters that he has created over these last few years. He just grows from strength to strength, and he, obviously he's known for dealing with strong female characters, but he's been doing a lot of interesting, quietly subversive kind of characterization of the men as well.
Harry Gamboa Jr. is co-founder of the East LA conceptual performance art group OSCO, and is a world-renowned artist whose work documenting the contemporary urban Chicano experience has been widely exhibited at museums and galleries internationally and in the U.S. He teaches at universities throughout Southern California, where he has used Love and Rockets as primary texts in the classroom. For Gamboa, the Hernandez brothers' portrayal of sexuality is a powerful political statement within the context of both Chicano culture and dominant culture.
Part of the effectiveness of the Hernandez brothers in presenting work that has the multivariate experience of sexuality presented in their characters is that the explicit denouncement of such activities by the average Chicano experience and the Chicano culture at large denies that this even occurs. And again, this is, on some level, fighting the fundamentalism of tradition. And it kind of points, by making these characters so visible and so obvious, that they become key points on the timeline, as it were, on the horizon that one must have to contest with, where maybe the vast population of people are not engaged in this. There is the possibility and there is the existence of people that do live this way, and they must be included for anyone to have the right to use the term equality. For anyone to even take on the role that they are fighting on behalf of human rights, one has to incorporate all human beings.
The popularity of Los Bros Hernandez attests to their effectiveness at reaching a diverse audience and bridging cultural and artistic worlds with innovative work. But paradoxically, perhaps one of the strongest indicators of Love and Rockets' power and effectiveness at challenging dominant paradigms can be seen in the exclusion of the brothers' work from the recent Masters of American Comics show at the MoCA and Hammer Museums here in Los Angeles. While the show was an important step in recognizing the artistic value and contribution of what has traditionally been considered a quote-unquote lowbrow form, the curator's exclusionary efforts to establish a canon of American comics masters based only on the work of 15 white male comics artists has tainted many viewers' impressions of the show, particularly fans and scholars of the Hernandez brothers' work. Although the official museum response has been to cite its goals of establishing a canon of formally innovative work, the argument still falls short when applied to many comics artists, especially Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez. Charles Hatfield explains.
Well, as a comic scholar and enthusiast and a teacher of comics here in Los Angeles, I felt blessed to have the exhibit here. Of course, it originated here, and it has moved on to Milwaukee, and it will be moving on later to New York. So I felt very blessed to have it, both because I was enraptured by the exhibit, but also because I could use it pedagogically. I revisited that exhibit many times. So it represents a new, well, not a new, but a gathering and an important kind of recognition, and it represents an important opportunity. So for a longtime follower of comics like myself, it seems like something of a blessing. Yet it also represents some omissions, some overlookings, by default, if not by design, unfortunate exclusions, and a narrowing of what comics are or what they might mean. The raison d'etre of the exhibit was to present a kind of formalist canon of those who were both innovative and unquestionably excellent from an aesthetic and a purely formalist point of view. And they made pretty good choices among their 15 as far as that goes. I think, though, that we always have to call the criteria for inclusion and the agenda of such exhibits into question. Now, to get to the matter at hand, the Hernandez brothers, I think on both a narrative and a formal and aesthetic ground, there's no question in my mind that both of them belong in the exhibit, even were the exhibit simply to be limited to 15 figures. I have no problem saying that. They are excellent cartoonists. They are genre-stretching, genre-shattering writers. Their work is graphically beautiful. It's formally innovative in terms of its transitions, its sequencing, its the way it sort of skips in, you know, kind of an uninhibited way across the comics page. So it's very innovative both in how it does things and what it brings thematically. It's just some of the most influential stuff in the last quarter century of American comics production. There is no way to deny that. So I felt that they ought to have been included, and it would have been appropriate and energizing to include them in the exhibit.
For Joy, the exclusions in the Masters of American Comics show were obvious and glaring, and she saw this as a clear reflection of curatorial elitism and fear.
These are decisions that a certain few people kind of in elitist positions are making. So if they're excluding people, it kind of reflects something on them, their decisions. I think that when you looked at that show, The Masters of American Comics, it was just too obvious that there was some exclusion. And I think it was just too obvious, maybe not to other people in the art world, but to people of color and women, I think for sure. I was excited that there was a comic show at at a museum, because comics have always, for a long time, has been excluded in the art world or not considered art. And it was cool. I was like excited when I first heard about it. And then when I looked through it, I'm like, wait, they're all men and they're all white men. And I'm like, wait a minute, that doesn't look too good. It's like excluding, and that kind of says something. They're calling these masters. And that was my first question to one of the curators. I think at least the Hernandez brothers should have been in that show. I think like museums or institutions, they're still afraid to include like something that speaks too much of a culture. I think there's still certain fears of including people of color.
As experienced and working Chicano artists, both Sandra de la Loza and Harry Gamboa Jr. also saw the show's exclusion as a reflection of fear based in ignorance and racism. Unfortunately, for both artists, this kind of exclusion and blind spot in the mainstream dominant art world was hardly surprising.
In general, Chicano art is really negated in LA art schools and in the US, and really is kind of more acknowledged and respected outside of the U.S. I mean, especially like in L.A., there's just this denial. There's just this complete denial of Chicano culture, or just the lack of willingness to even like discuss that history, culture, reality, experience.
The decisions not to include are as important as those decisions to include. So the decisions not to include, I would venture to say, have a great basis in racism, in ignorance, even of West Coast culture, of the Southwest. These are people who are completely unaware of the Chicano influence and the respect that's deserved by such artists as the Hernandez brothers. And I would encourage people to voice her opinions regarding this issue. It seems that the idea of marginalizing certain artists, again, follows the pattern where if it's included into the spectrum of what is visible, it has a tendency to point out the inherent flaws, the discoloration, the possibility that maybe other types of works are actually ugly, and at the very least, that one would even have to consider the fact that Chicanos can produce creative work that is co-equal with any cultural production in the world, then causes people to have to reevaluate their perception of the Chicano culture as a whole. It's only been up until quite recently that external forces, meaning international forces, other people paying close attention to the development and the production of Chicano works, that American institutions have had to then reassess their own positions due to international pressures as opposed to internal pressures. For the Hernandez brothers to feel that they've been marginalized, well, as is evident with the Hammer Show and the Mocha Show, it's part of the same runaround that institutions have been giving other artists for many years. And it's not to be expected that people who have no awareness of Chicano culture and no appreciation of Chicano culture could possibly find themselves suddenly trying to include some work that is actually of great value. And it points to their own ignorance and points to their lack of awareness. And in the end, I believe they also will be judged as having failed not only the Chicano community, but the art community at large.
For Brian Tucker, as a gallery curator, the exclusion was also obvious. Although he appreciated the recognition of comics artists in the Masters of American Comics show, he immediately questioned not only the show's exclusions, but its basic premises.
What was the why this premise of only 15 artists and 15 masters, so-called? And I think that it was really surprising to me that these museums, which are pretty sophisticated museums usually, the Hammer and Mocha, would embrace such a sort of musty curatorial premise as we are identifying the masters and we are forming a canon. And there certainly has been many years of criticism of that kind of great man history, version of history, and so forth. And I can't believe that if one of those institutions was trying to mount a similar survey of 20th century American painting or sculpture or photography or you know, whatever, video art, whatever they consider to be within their main area of competence, that they would dare say that it was the masters and now we're trying to create a canon. And I also don't think they would not have anybody from Southern California in the show, or that they would feel comfortable with a show that was all white males. But that's what happened here.
In response, Tucker curated a popular exhibition of the Hernandez brothers' work at the Pasadena City College Gallery in November of 2005. He says that the Pasadena show has gone a long way toward challenging and rectifying the Masters of American Comics exclusion, resulting in renewed international attention on the work of Jaime and Gilbert Hernandez.
People were really pretty much delighted by it. The sense I got was that there was a kind of level of interest, both in terms of people coming from off campus and in terms of people coming from around campus, and a sort of grassroots interest among students that was not typical for shows here. And, you know, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, there are a lot of people who know that work, and or at least have heard of it, and, you know, find ways to relate to that that they may not if they're not practiced in looking at a typical gallery art. So I think it was generally quite well received, and it also has been a show that continues to have a life, even though it closed in early December and we're talking now in April. But not only do I have you interviewing me about it, but some students from Brown University have been contacting me recently, planning to do some sort of Love and Rockets exhibition there, and they wanted to know about the show. I've had people from Belgium and Australia and the UK wanting pictures of the show, wanting to know if the work was for sale, wanting, you know, more interest, having a continued interest in that work. Somebody fairly recently was talking to me who is writing an article specifically about the Masters of Comics show, and they wanted to address the Hernandez brothers exhibition here as well, and perhaps talk about some of the limitations of the master show. Yeah, I think that the reception's been good, and that's very heartening for me.
Despite their exclusion from the Masters of American Comics show, Amy Gerstler is also heartened by the growing awareness of the Hernandez brothers' work.
The way I comforted myself was I thought this show is like the Big Bang. It's gonna spawn a whole universe of life, of shows, of many solo shows by Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez, as they so deserve. Many more books by them. Many, all kinds of things, get people talking, get people to realize that this is, make a comic art museum. I mean, why does America not seem to really have one? France does, and it has a lot of American comics in it, from what I understand.
And while the curators at MoCA and the Hammer Museum may have failed with regard to Love and Rockets, as an educator, Gerstler promotes the work of the Hernandez brothers for use in the classroom and the community, and she's not the only one. Charles Hatfield has worked to establish a place in academia for Los Bros Hernandez and other comics artists, and Harry Gamboa Jr. insists that the work of Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez has immense pedagogical value at all levels of education.
I think they're a wonderful thing to use, because when I was much younger, I was an aide in a remedial reading class at Venice High School, and that class was full of people who were about to graduate from high school, many of whom were Latino, who could not read very well at all because they had just come to the country, or they had not had good educations, and or, you know, they didn't have books at home. And the materials that they were trying to use in the class to teach these mostly guys who were like, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-old guys to read were like Dick and Jane primers, which, understandably, they had absolutely no interest in. And every time I see Love and Rockets, one thing I think is, if we had had those in the classroom, these guys would have learned to read, because here's interesting, vital, age-appropriate, sexy, dramatic, fascinating stuff. Not, you know, see Jane go.
As a teacher, I use them both in the context of comic books per se, when I'm teaching, as I'm teaching now, an experimental course on comic books, as you know. I also have taught them in other contexts, simply as works of contemporary literature. I've taught them in courses that were sort of composition workshops about literature, in which alongside canonical works of poetry and of fiction, we would read a volume of, let's say, Gilbert Hernandez. So I've taught them within that context, which was not comic-centered. And then again, I've taught them in the comic-centered context. I teach them because I think they're important. I teach them because I think they're often disarmingly direct, enjoyable, and pleasurable for students to read. A few students have taken umbrage at sexual explicitness or other elements, but most have been very happily surprised, especially those with no prior sense that comics could cover these kind of topics, could deal with the lives of Chicanos and Chicanas, could deal with the lives of people in Central America, that could deal with punk and with aspects of youth culture.
My contention, by bringing it into the classroom at a university level, was that I was actually bringing it to these students at a very late stage in their development. This is the kind of work that should be presented in middle school and in high school. This is the kind of material that provides great insight into the social structure, the psychology of people, the ability of people to create their own personas. This might actually provide a sense of hope and motivation for students to learn and to develop a sense of newness about their world, as opposed to the kind of results that we get from the LA City schools, which produce nothing short of absolute failure. Which is definitely a civil rights violation to have so many young people lose out. I would actually refer to it, maybe put it a little bit stronger, that it's it equates with educational genocide to have so many young people lose out on their education and their ability to participate in society fully. The Hernandez brothers, their work, by their ability to utilize a somewhat complex approach to viewing life and incorporating various theories. I was at a lecture by the Hernandez brothers at Northridge last year, and they kept denying that they had any intent to intellectualize anything, and that could be possible. However, their works have the effect of intellectualizing Chicano culture and connecting the seemingly disparate elements of barrio life, of violence, of sexuality, of dreaming, of hoping, and of fighting for justice. They have the ability of bringing it and distilling it in such a way
that actually makes it cool. And when something is cool, it could be acceptable amongst young people. And the fact that young people could accept something that's cool, that is progressive, as opposed to accepting things that are violent and destructive and nihilistic, as the current free market promotes, I believe it's one of the reasons that it is marginalized, because it tends to fly in the face of the self-destructive point of view that capitalism promotes. The country runs right through a sand, it doesn't even blink an eye. Living off the poor man's labor, sucking all our spirit dry. We say this democracy is laced with their hypocrisy. It's true.
These days, as recognition of their work grows, the prolific Hernandez brothers continue to expand the Love and Rockets universe. Even though Gilbert lives in Las Vegas with his family, and Jaime lives in Los Angeles with his own family, the brothers work long distance to carry on the stories of Hopi, Maggie, Luba, and Luba's daughters, as the characters continue to age in real time along with the brothers and their fans. Although Jaime admits the process is somewhat more lonely than the old days when he and Gilbert both lived in Southern California, through email, fax, telephone, and other communications, they still develop their narratives in parallel tandem fashion. In addition, both Gilbert and Jaime have developed side solo projects, including comprehensive anthology publications by Fantagraphics Publishers. Most recently, Gilbert also published an irreverent and hilarious DVD and comic book of his Channel Zero local Las Vegas public access TV show, The Naked Cosmos. And Jaime has continued the saga of Hopi and Maggie on the pages of the New York Times in a special extended serialization. After 25 years and thousands of pages of brilliant, innovative work, Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez continue to push the boundaries of Chicano, American, and international literature and comics art. This concludes Fear of Chicano Comics, Los Bros Hernandez, Maestros of the Anti-Canon. This program was created as part of Dr. Gabriel Gutierrez's Chicanos in the Media course in the Chicano-Chicano Studies Department at California State University, Northridge. Special thanks to Teresa Covarrubias and Rudy Medina for the music of The Brat. Look for a 32-track compilation of The Brat's music soon.